Welcome to New Lens with ComGood Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I am here today with Common Good's most recent hire, Stephen Hester. Stephen is the Vice President of Investments here at Common Good, and he'll be leading those efforts. But prior to that, Stephen's most recent roles, he was Director of Due Diligence at Ladenburg Thalmann and Advisor Group, two of the largest independent broker-dealers in the United States. Stephen has performed investment and operational due diligence on hundreds of offerings encompassing all major asset classes, including real estate, infrastructure, private equity, hedge funds, and energy. I think just by the background, you understand why he's such a valuable part of Common Good. Stephen, welcome, and look forward to sharing you and learning more about you personally.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Jeff.
Why don't you give us a little background of yourself, where you grew up, where'd you go to school, and then a high level of your career.
So I grew up in Houston, Texas, which I'm only a few hundred miles from now. I have one little brother. Both my parents still live in Houston, different parts, but still have a lot of family there nonetheless. And once that 18 years in Houston ended, that was to go to University of Texas in Austin. So that's where I live now. I've lived here, I'm 37. So what is that, 18, 19 years that I've now lived in Austin. And at UT, it's sort of funny now because it makes more sense in hindsight, but I ended up going into economics and Mandarin Chinese. So one of my main focuses is on developmental economics. You need to choose your coursework, right, to some degree. And I still, to this day, find that subject matter very fascinating of what kind of policies and structures can you put into a place and turn it from what Singapore was to what it is today. You know, it's very complicated. It involves a lot of variables, but it's very fascinating. And then in terms of grad school, my objective was perhaps a little different than others in the sense that it wasn't really for money or prestige. I would say the best way to put it is it was just to learn about the world and myself. I saved up money from working not very luxurious jobs, including valet at night and some other items, so that I would pick that school organically and not be too heavily influenced by any other variable. And I took the LSAT a couple times, the GRE. You know, I'm a sort of a decision-making type of guy. You know, I'm in due diligence, right? I have to make difficult decisions. And who knows, maybe I overthought this one, but regardless, it worked out in a good way. I ended up going back to UT, which I didn't actually anticipate. I figured the probability that would be pretty low, but they had this very unique program with a vague name, Energy and Earth Resources, EER for short. And it doesn't, there's not a ton of students, maybe like 10 a semester or so, but it figuratively and to some degree literally opens the door to the university. So even though, as you guys just learned, I studied, you know, economics and Chinese, I was able to study almost anything I wanted. You had to be able to tie it back to energy in a way, but everything ties back to energy. There's really nothing that doesn't. I studied different types of engineering. That's kind of what I specialized in. I took law school classes related to energy law. I took MBA courses on derivatives, just to give you kind of a few examples. And while my thesis was on enhanced oil recovery, which no surprise was primarily involved in kind of petroleum engineering and geology, really the coursework and the thesis is a little more, I guess, nuanced than that. There's probably 20% of that work is in renewables. A lot of the engineering I focused on was on the efficiency of like our natural gas infrastructure. In some ways, it's far better than people, right, might knee-jerk reaction think. And in other ways, there's a lot of methane leaking, which people don't talk about. And it's about 1,000 times more damaging in terms of the heat generation capacity of the atmosphere than carbon. So hopefully that just gave me a more science or engineering-based understanding of how those things work. But that's my grad school component. And then you already touched on a career a good amount, but I started off as a securities trader for a hedge fund. That was during the Great Recession. And as I've said many times, it's kind of like being on the front lines trying to learn how to use a 22 rifle or something. It was pretty wild, and it was very humbling and was a great education. And then I went to due diligence, have been doing some derivative of that, you know, ever since.
Do you know why the interest at a young age in this case, energy?
Part of it, I would say, which is sort of a predictable response, is when you grow up in Houston.
Right.
It's kind of like you're almost silly not to be at least interested because, especially in the past, it's actually not the case anymore. I think maybe only 5% of Houston's regional GDP is from oil and gas, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, it was like 20%. And so that was just a big part of kind of the culture there. And then I also did an internship that helped me pay for undergrad significantly for National Oil of Arco. So they don't drill for any oil technically, but they're like a Schlumberger. I think they're a little bit smaller than Schlumberger, but they're an oil service firm. And I would literally leave school after exams. I only had a motorcycle back then. I would go straight to Houston next morning, 5:30 a.m. I was in the distribution center organizing all kinds of projects. And I did that every summer, every Christmas. It was like my second home almost. But it was okay money, especially for a student. And that really helped me get through school without taking on too much debt.
So you gave us your age, which you didn't have to, but full disclosure there. How would you describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
Yeah, and I think these are really good questions just to ask yourself even. So I like these, and this is going to mostly be off the cuff. I would say that in terms of a life journey, this relates to probably what we'll talk about in the future, but there was a bit of a sharp financial change in my family when I was a teenager, relatively young, maybe 13, 14. Like most things in life, there's positive and negatives even to crises, theoretically, right? And I think actually you can learn more from those. It's very difficult, but you can learn as much or more from those than really anything else. The point of that, why I bring it up, is that it taught me the importance of having a solid financial foundation, as some of the things I've already mentioned sort of tend toward, right, in terms of how paying for school, et cetera. And so I had a very, maybe even too relentless of a focus of getting that squared away. So a lot of kind of my 20s and early 30s was getting those kind of boxes checked. I don't know if I'll ever get them fully checked. I think the more responsibility you take on, they tend to grow right over time. Mm-hmm. But that was a big part of it. And I wouldn't say that stopped me from getting married, but I think it would be silly to assume it didn't have an influence.
Okay.
If you think of, we'll do a little arithmetic. If I finished my CFA years ago and I'm 37, I went to grad school. There isn't much time in between there where I wasn't working one or two jobs and kind of going to school or something like that full time. A really beneficial kind of change or evolution there is I did get married to my wife almost exactly a year ago. So it's kind of fun. My 1 year anniversary is in 2 days, by the way.
All right.
Yeah. So it at least made it this far, which is great.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. But yeah, and my wife, and we did date for a few years prior to getting engaged, getting married. But that certainly is another humbling kind of experience where you are trying to build, I don't know if institution is the right word for it, but trying to build a foundation, not just for yourself, right, but for more and more people and taking on more responsibility. So I'd say that's kind of where I'm at right now. And we're hoping to have kids in the relatively near future. And we should have another podcast so I can say that everything I thought I knew was probably totally, totally wrong, which is okay. And then one other aspect I would like to mention is I grew up going to church and I would say being moderately engaged and probably didn't do as good of a job as I should have over the years. And then perhaps for one reason or another, you know, my wife is from Mexico and is very Catholic. As people in Mexico are kind of familiar with it, it probably doesn't surprise them. And so since we started dating, one of the very first things she said was how important that is to her. And so that's been a great, I won't say addition, that's not a word for it, but enhancement kind of my life as well. And so I'm hoping to keep going in that direction as well.
When did you realize the power of capital and what does that mean to you?
The first way is a very granular one, but I think is perhaps more powerful than even I remember sometimes or kind of pay respect to, which is that I've been in a position where your car breaks down and you have no plan B, where going to school requires some serious sacrifices, where not understanding some basic components of personal finance coupled with not having a lot of financial resources, you know, it's a serious problem. Like it's not just a thing. If you can't harness a little bit of capital on an individual basis here, or whether in India or Mexico, there's not a limit on what you can achieve, but it reduces the probability of what you can do dramatically. And so whether it's personally or helping someone else reach kind of this threshold, and it's actually somewhat mathematically proven, there's a certain amount of savings, et cetera, you need, right? If you want to create a company, whatever the case is, you either need some help through some lending, or you got to save some capital. It doesn't really matter how, right? You just got to do it. So that's kind of on a very granular personal level. And then on a larger scale, I'll use a perhaps an unpopular example, which is traditional oil and gas. And as Jeff knows, I'm a supporter of smart utilization of energy in general. Let's put it that way.
Yep.
Even though on the terms of renewables, I am perhaps a little bit above average educated on how the mechanics work and the economics and even the physics, I'm humble enough to recognize there's other parts of the energy sector that are very important. And today's a great example, right? It's not fun to pay $5.50 for gas. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a complicated situation, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But if you look in Germany, it's not that complicated. They're paying 10 times the natural gas prices we are. So you just have to be kind of very thoughtful and prudent about where you put capital and I guess where you don't. You know, they all have consequences. You're going to need billions and billions of capital allocated into the right places, not only to generate attractive return for investors, but to make society function. And that's kind of where the parallel is, right? From the sort of arguably misallocation resources in one area or the other, is there's actually a very serious penalty to people who have nothing to do with that investment allocation, right? Like we as stewards of capital, you know, it's a complicated process to figure out who your stakeholders are, but obviously there's a lot of consequences to society in general if say renewables don't get enough attention or investment, right? Or other kinds of infrastructure, or small business lending, or these other mechanisms that can, in my opinion, do have the propensity to generate really good returns, but are also just absolutely critical to giving the average person, you know, a shot.
Mm. You've got the capital component that you just talked about, and you actually said the word that I was going to bring up next is, what does stewardship mean to you? Or choose some other word that's in that genre if it's more applicable.
I don't know if I'll give as succinct answer as I'll desire, but I'll start with my home base, which is on due diligence. Making sure that you understand what the capital is doing, who's involved, what are the incentive structures. That alone will get you pretty far.
Mm-hmm.
The incentive structure part in particular. And it's not as simple, even though this element is actually not that simple. It isn't as simple as just understanding what the asset manager is incentivized to do, like, for instance, to make money.
Mm-hmm.
What is the incentive on a larger scale of where this capital is going? You know, what is it going to create? What is it going to destroy? You know, is it, you know, one element that Jeff and I, for example, have some influence over is how is the investment structured in the first place? In my opinion, that is not really figured out, and maybe never will be, but there's a lot of room for improvement. Meaning as a good sort of steward of capital or allocator of capital, which has a lot of overlap, is making sure that the investors, A, have good access to those investments, that they're being used properly, you know, how the manager says they're going to be used, and that the effect of all of that is something you understand, even if maybe there's elements of it they don't like, but at least you understand it. And then to the extent you can have all parties involved know what I just said. Right. Because it's different. Like if I'm the due diligence guy and I'm the only one that understands it, then I probably am not getting enough feedback, right, from perhaps the investor or from some other party that's involved. And so I think being a good steward of that capital involves all of those elements. So it's not easy, I guess, but it is very doable. And, you know, I think people do it every day.
But if you were in traditional finance, like which is where you and I grew up, now you've pivoted over to this impact space. You've been consulting with us for a couple months and now you're full-time on board. So it may be a little bit too early to ask this question, but have you noticed any differences in this impact world versus where you're at, or is it the same thing?
I think there's more overlap than not, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And where there are some differences, I think are in many ways pretty easy to resolve. So a good example that we've discussed a few times is no one understands exactly what impact investing means. And they definitely don't understand what ESG means. and those aren't, that isn't anything negative, right? These are just how it works. And then even within those elements, people kind of weight them very differently. So in traditional finance, some nerdy guy like me will explain what sort of risk-adjusted XYZ is needed, what kind of diversification is expected, what kind of assets and the pluses and minuses of assets. But I think everyone's more or less on the same page as to what they're going for. And we're still figuring that out on the impact side a little bit. It's more interesting. It's more exciting. There's more passion. And I think there's more potential. I really do. And hopefully we'll help, right? Maybe we'll help categorize some of these things where it's a little more streamlined and a little bit easier for people to engage. You know, and another element that is a little tricky as well, although I have focused primarily in complex like alternative investments that have a suitability standard, I help create risk frameworks on ETFs and just all kinds of other types of investments. It's pretty easy in traditional finance to come up with an option for almost anyone. Like if someone has $1,000 in savings, they want to invest in something, you know, credit to traditional finance, someone has figured that out, right, for the most part. Impact investing is still primarily and borderline exclusively, you know, in the alternative investments component. And those firms, I think in general, have done a good job of what their goals have been. And it takes a lot of time and resources and legal aid and consultants to figure out how to then streamline that into a broader market. To me, that's a great thing because that just means there's going to be way more potential, right? And way more capital going into it. But there is going to be some work done before, say, some, I won't get into any technical stuff here, but more 1940 Act funds, or, you know, there's some relatively straightforward ways that we can do it. At least on the surface, it's straightforward. We'll see behind the scenes, but it's a fun challenge.
Well, and you just articulated part of why myself and the rest of the team have come from traditional finance into this impact space. And for a second, let's just take off the word impact and just argue that it's a newer industry. So you're still at the early stages, and all the things that you just talked about, we've seen happen. I've seen happen go from unit investment trusts to ETFs, which are, you know, and then I've watched what's happened in the alternative space where 20 years ago, well, why would you invest in anything that's, you know, not a stock and bond? And then I think we're about, I mean, we're watching that wave happen where people are like, hey, I would love to invest in either solving some big world problems and or I would love to align my values. But there's a transition, and that's why there's significant upside, because still need to figure out how to scale it.
Agreed.
Yeah. So specifically for you, and you can answer this personally, it can be from a professional standpoint, how are you trying to change the world?
I'm going to give two answers, just because it's really one answer, but two parts, I suppose. The first one is, I think individual measurable actions are very important and really not recognized that much. As much as, like, in society, the amount of people that spend time on Twitter, for example, versus spend time helping a kid struggling in the neighborhood, I don't know what the ratio is, but I bet you it's not very good. You know what I mean? And so I think on a very, here's like just a kind of a crazy fact I was thinking of earlier today. So I've been doing Big Brothers Big Sisters for a long time. You know, it's a big commitment, but it's also not, right? And I get more out of it than Jarvis, the kid that I that has been on like family to me at this point. I get as much out of it as he does. So I consider it really just an honor to be able to do it. Austin has like a 2-year backlog for male volunteers, because it's male on male and female on female, right? So, and I'm in Austin, Texas, yet that to me is not good. Let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. And so the point of all that is just little things you can do, seemingly little. I mean, there's 300 million people in the U.S., what, 150 million adults that aren't, you know, that are of working age, let's say. If each one of them just did a little something, there wouldn't be a kid in the U.S. that didn't either have a parent or some kind of mentor or whatever. I don't even know what that world would look like, but I think it'd look a lot better than it probably does now. And there's a lot of ways you can do that. Of course, big brothers, big sisters, one example, could be through church. It can be, I'm sure there's an infinite ways to do it, but that's sort of the little granular one that is easy to do, that there's no excuses and it's not very complicated. And then the other one is in trying to change the world to the capital question you asked before, and what kind of power does it have, its stewardship, et cetera. Maybe our specific impact will be modest, but if you take 1,000 of us, it isn't so modest anymore, right? It really can move mountains. And so I think pushing capital, and it's not just that, right? Because the capital doesn't move until people understand. People aren't going to put money into a renewable fund, generally speaking, unless they're at least interested, they are curious to learn more about the effects, and just becoming more educated on, just for that example, it could be small business and everything else. So moving people and their capital into areas where there's certain benefits to society as well as to themselves, right? There's nothing wrong with earning, in my opinion, at least a good return on capital while helping people. I think really that's the key to our entire economy. I think that works. You know, I think you can make a big impact by just working really hard to help educate people and therefore push capital into parts of the economy that need the resources and need the help. And if you think about it, it's kind of amazing, right? If there could be very awesome opportunities in every way, impact, economic, et cetera, but for whatever reason, there just isn't enough education or maybe even enough fund structuring, something like there's a little bit of a roadblock. So if you remove that, it's not like we're not the geniuses here that figured it all out. But if we can remove the roadblock and help educate people on the opportunity that's already there, I mean, that's it, right? You open the dam and the water goes through. I really do think that can help.
Yeah. And I think what's exciting is not only could you influence the way that capital is invested, and of course, the implications of how that capital is invested impacts people, the world, whatnot. But then I'm also extremely passionate about, you know, it's what you said earlier in a different context, you get a lot out of serving. And the same thing I think is true when you think about how you invest, when you think about aligning your values, you get something out of it besides the return. I talk about joy and freedom, knowing that your capital is helping the world and aligning with your values. So I think there's that whole other component as well that it's why I started Common Good, was to figure out how do you get thousands of investors across the United States to start to experience that. And the other thing is there's only so much money in the world that's in the philanthropic and charity buckets. And you know, I won't quote all the numbers, but it's this tiny little speck. The majority of capital sitting in, you know, business and investments. And so that's, to me, that's the pot of gold to make a huge difference. All right, so we're going to end this thing with, maybe it's the hardest question of, if you could have a dream come true, what would that be?
I would go ahead and rate that one as probably the hardest question.
Yeah.
I will say creating a institution, a family unit, something of productive capacity that's helping people, et cetera, that just outlives me. Hmm. Like where I've served a worthwhile purpose. And I'm not picky on exactly what it'll be. I think that's a little ostentatious. I don't know how it'll work out, but being able to be healthy enough and have enough discipline and everything to create something that just helps and is productive for long after me.
So not to put words in your mouth, that's about legacy. Is that what you're thinking?
I'd say legacy, except I don't care if it is associated with me.
Okay.
So that doesn't make any difference if my name is on it at all. But yeah, it's certainly related.
If you could choose today, how would you like that influence to look?
I think, this could sound cheesy, but I don't care because it's honest, is I think a version and perhaps a bigger version of what Common Good is doing. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense because I joined your firm. So you know, it's not total BS here, right? where these different parts of the world that don't either have enough attention or enough help through capital or something else, creating a system or a platform that just connects those people, you know, and it's happening, right? Like it's already, the dots are being connected already. But I think that would be an amazing way to do it and could go on and on. And instead of a BlackRock, it may sound audacious here, but instead of a BlackRock. It's, you know, and it can even be a return profile. It doesn't necessarily have to be sacrificed materially. Maybe in some cases, probably in some it would, where those connections are made, right? Where it connects, whether it's small business, you know, I just really like that one, which is why I keep bringing it up, but microfinance, et cetera, where those areas is just, it's completely streamlined. It's completely liquid. And the capital markets is in all those areas, and they get to, you know, experience some of the benefit you and I have right in our lives. So I think that would be one good example.
I guess I lied. I am going to ask one more question. How do you think being married to your wife, who's from Mexico, how do you think that's shaping or has shaped or will shape your views going forward?
I think it really does make me function on a little bit higher and more thoughtful level. It makes me think a little bit more long-term. The Catholic Church, you know, you get civilly married and they almost don't pay any attention to that, right? That's just, and part of the reason, by the way, is in Mexico, they actually are separated. So there's some logic behind that, at least for people from Mexico, which many Catholics in the U.S. are. But you have to go through a process, right, with the priest. There's like a several hundred question Q&A you and your wife do, and you get to compare answers, which is pretty exciting. Luckily, if you ever talk to my wife, she'll tell you we scored really, really well out of that, which I'm thankful for. But is, I bring that up because when I'm integrated with her, that means I'm more integrated in the church, which means I'm thinking, I think, better and with a greater purpose. And even on just how I imagine my theoretical, if I'm lucky, future kids' lives, the way that I'm thinking about that and the decisions I'm making today to help them, hopefully, you know, in the future, has been materially impacted for sure by our fairly close engagement, you know, with our local kind of Catholic church here. There's some other elements too, just little tangents, which are still very important around the value of family and having something you do with your family on a regular basis. You know, particularly later in my childhood and early development, I mean, let's just say there wasn't a lot of that, just to make a long story short. And with her, her family, they have a lot more traditions, and a lot of it is connected, right, to the church. And I think that's refreshing. And particularly, you know, as a single guy, you know, you can kind of just live out in the woods. You know, you can kind of figure it out. But once you do have the wife and you have kids, and it's frankly very little about you, it's just the way I'm looking at it. Sure. And more about others. The church has, I think, a lot to teach there.
Back in my CNL days, I had a head of our, actually, she would have been compliance, so not due diligence. Although I think due diligence may have reported up to her. But anyways, this lady, and I won't say her name or not, but like you think of somebody who does what you all do or in your genre, I mean, it's pretty tight. I mean, you guys, you're looking at processes, procedures and all that kind of analysis. Yet I think about what she did and her spare time, and you it does not even fit the personality. And it's a little bit the same with you. So give our listeners some of the things that you love to do apart from work that might shock people to think that somebody who analyzes investments all day, this is what they like to do.
All right. Well, I'll give the obvious one because the other one's probably the obvious one. And I don't even know how much I've told you on this, Jess. There might be a little bit of news on it, but, part of what I also was doing in my 20s and early 30s was that I had some slightly ambitious traveling goals, and I've always been a motorcycle guy. And so I tried to do it like clockwork every 2 years. I didn't quite make that mark, but it was pretty close. I would either take a motorcycle or go rent one in a place. Usually I didn't even know anyone who'd ever been there, and I would explore the whole place.
Wow.
So that's pretty vague, but my last one, I started in Croatia, which I've actually, I'd been to Croatia once before on the end of another trip. If you think of Europe and you kind of start from Spain, right, and you zigzag around, my motorcycle kept breaking down by the time I got to Croatia. So I kind of cut back across to Spain where I got the motorcycle from. So the next trip, I started in Croatia and headed towards Turkey. And so I went to all the countries in between. So all ex-Yugoslavia, Romania. I kind of sadly wish I had gone to Ukraine. It's such a large country, especially when you're on a motorcycle by yourself. It's completely flat and not terribly interesting to get to like Kyiv, for example.
Yeah.
Now I wish I had taken the time to do it, but part of the reason I kind of mentioned it is yes, I went to Kosovo and Albania and Montenegro and all these other places there, which are not, some of them, by the way, should be top vacation spots, believe it or not, particularly okay. in Albania. But I just like to understand how the world works. Uh-huh. And it's hard to figure that out, in my opinion, sometimes without seeing it for yourself. So it gives you a very realistic view. And then the final point I'll make on that is it's actually not as different as what I do in due diligence than you think, because like managing risk is not avoiding risk.
Yeah.
It's understanding what can go wrong and mitigating it.
Yeah. That's a good analogy.
There's no better stress test than showing up in Croatia on a motorbike and then going to Turkey and near the Syrian border. And then, you know, and I had pretty expensive healthcare, you know, that I had where a helicopter could pick me up anywhere in the area and transport me eventually to the US. So I took a lot of measures, but in a way it's like one giant due diligence risk management problem is one way to look at it anyways.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's cool. Yeah. Well, thank you for opening up and sharing a little bit about you and what makes you tick. It's a pleasure for me to be able to do these interviews, and I always learn something. So this was good. So don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.